I guess last week Bud called me and made a request for a talk on compassion. And I had been thinking about something else, but it's always very nice to get a request for what interests people here. And so I was just kind of thinking then this last week about the subject of compassion and wondering, you know, what I know about it and what I could talk about it and what I know just from my own experience about it. And it seemed a little bit, in my own ruminations about it, it seems actually a little bit tricky, the concept or the idea of compassion and what it actually is. It's easy to kind of say the word compassion, and it's easy to make a definition to it. But, you know, as soon as you say the word, you know, it's like, where is it? The word, it disappeared. And I was wondering, you know, so I thought about it, you know, so I reviewed, so I spent this kind of, what compassion has been for me in my life, in my relationships to the word or the concept, the idea, the sentiment. And I thought that maybe it would be a nice way to talk about it a little bit, is talk a little bit about my background around the word. And I appreciated very much, you know, Bud's request about compassion, his interest in it. And there's, as often, many people feel that compassion is an important subject, and many people feel that, maybe all people at some point or other, feel that they could use more of it, either for themselves or for their friends or just for their world or from their friends. It's something we all feel need for. But I find it very interesting that sometimes if we look more carefully at where the need or the wish for compassion comes from, like if we feel like we need to be more compassionate towards ourselves, if you look more carefully at that wish itself, because people might feel, oh, I'm not very compassionate to myself and I wish I could have more compassion. And if you look more carefully at that wish to be compassionate, the recognition of the pain that's there and the pain of not being sufficiently compassionate, that itself is a movement of compassion. That to feel the pain and to desire to be more compassionate, that desire for that well-being, a desire to alleviate that suffering, that itself is a movement of compassion. So often, I see oftentimes people who feel like they lack compassion and want compassion, actually they have it. And sometimes all you need to do is turn the mirror back on yourself. And it might be a very small amount, but it's a small amount goes a long way. We water it, and it grows and it grows. And that desire, you know, for more compassion, I think that desire tends to arise out of a place of being vulnerable and kind of tender. And that vulnerable, tender place is a place that can feel pain, is also the seed, the place where compassion can grow. Buddhism's highest ideals is wisdom and compassion. It's considered to be the two pillars or two wings of Buddhism. However, in saying its ideals, it's very easy to get caught up in the ideals, as if the ideal is something we have to become or be. And the ideal becomes something outside of ourselves that we then try to live up to, rather than using Buddhism as a mirror for ourselves. Because I don't think, you know, Buddhism is not an answer to anything, has been said sometimes. And many people come to Buddhism looking for some answer. But I think in its highest form, Buddhism is not an answer for anything at all. And it's rather disappointing as an answer. But what it is, Buddhism is a suggestion to look back at yourself. It's like a mirror for yourself. And so Buddhism offers a practice, offers tools and ways of paying attention, noticing, so we can discover for ourselves what is true, not what Buddhism tells us is true, not the answers that Buddhism you think might give you. So the ideals of wisdom and compassion are not meant as ideals, you know, then to kind of incorporate, but rather perhaps as mirrors to use and to reflect in our own life, find out who we are more fully and more accurately. And it's in the act of doing that that we discover compassion anyway. You don't discover compassion by reading books about it, I don't think. And you're not going to discover much compassion by listening to me tonight. But if you use a subject and look at yourself, that's where you find it. And I think it's a very important subject, because it's easy to imagine that we all need more wisdom. I mean, that's, you know, everybody's humble enough to feel like he used a little bit more wisdom. But the other half of it, the compassion part, many of us don't go around thinking I could use more compassion. But the two are equally important in Buddhist practice, is the development of both. And they develop together. And related to this thing about ideals and not getting caught up in ideals, you hear this, the expression often in our circles about working with emotions, working with difficulties, working with emotional difficulties, working with the hindrances. And I'm a little bit leery of the word working, even though I use it myself, because it implies you're going to do something with what's arising, as if something wrong with what's happening, and you have to do something with it. You have to get rid of it, or change it, or make it better, or transform it into something wonderful and nice. And I think what we're asked to do in this wonderful mirror that Buddhism wants to give ourselves, a mirror of awareness, is just really fully be with who we are, with what's going on. And if we feel, for example, suffering, if we feel angry, or feel depressed, or feel happy, or joyful, it's very dangerous to have this idea, I'm going to work with this now. I'm going to work with my anger and make it better. I'm going to work with my suffering and, you know, make it go away. Rather, the miraculous thing of our practice is simply to turn the mirror of awareness on that and feel tenderly, feel fully, what is this actually? What is my life right now? What is it to be authentic right now in the midst of this? Not to kind of try to make it go away. To feel the texture, the flavor of it in the body and the mind. So both Buddhism and Bud has stimulated me to think about compassion and what it is for me. And I was surprised in my reflections this week that in thinking back over my life, that the word compassion didn't enter my vocabulary. It wasn't a word that I used at all, I don't think, until I started my Buddhist practice. I mean, I managed life relatively well without the word, and it wasn't a significant or important word. But it was kind of with the beginning of Buddhist practice, it somehow it snuck in into my vocabulary, into my presence, and became important for me. And that to me was a surprise. I hadn't, to see its intimate connection with that beginning of practice. And also I noticed that the word compassion, the use of the word compassion, the recognition of it, of what something of compassion, kind of entered into me unconsciously. It kind of became a part of my vocabulary before I became conscious of its importance for me. So it kind of, the practice itself kind of maybe tenderized myself, or softened myself, or sensitized myself in such a way that this expression, this idea of compassion, then kind of snuck in through the back door. It crept up on me. However, when I look back, kind of before I started practicing, you know, what the influences in my life that might have, you know, that informed me about compassion, that kind of was a role model for me in compassion, or kind of, I think about my mother, she never used the word compassion. I didn't think of her as being a compassionate person. But there were things that she did growing up that were small things, I suppose, but they had a big impact on me. And I remember she would, it wasn't so much in America, but I grew up a lot in Europe. And whenever there was something, someone had an accident or their car had broken down the side of the road, she'd always stop. And often she would stop and she would spend hours and hours taking care of them, you know, getting them the car fixed and taking them to garages. And it just seemed like that's what you do. You know, she wasn't teaching me anything, you know, this is what you should do, or telling me I should do this. That was what was modeled for me. And then it struck me also that at some point she went out and bought a first aid kit to have in the car. And she told me she wasn't getting it for us. She was getting it because she'd stop for people in the car, you know, and if people had accidents, and she'd have a kit ready. And, you know, and so, you know, it's maybe kind of a very small thing, but you all know how impressionable young kids are. And so this made a big impact on me. It's just, it's a matter of course. It's a matter of what you do. You respond. So then I started doing my Buddhist practice. And as I think occurs for many people when they start practicing, sooner or later, the mirror of awareness shows us who we are, and some of what we are is is very painful. There's a lot of suffering within us often, a lot of unresolved conflict, a lot of unresolved memories, a lot of guilt, a lot of fear, a lot of anger, a lot of clinging, a lot of insecurity. And I had all of them, you know. And so I sat there and this stuff just started coming. All these things, and a lot of guilt. Guilt was like a really common theme for me. A lot of fear. And I was doing Zen practice then, and no one told me anything about this. No one told me about guilt and fear and emotions and meditation practice, and no one told me how to work with it, because, that's not what you do in Zen. And so it was kind of a blessing not to be told to do anything with it, because then I didn't do anything with it. And I just let it come, you know, just all the stuff came, and I just tried to be a good Zen student, and just all the stuff came, and I kind of didn't pay too much attention to it exactly. I just allowed it to come, all the stuff, and for years, just all the stuff, you know, and I was amazed at what was going on in my mind. And all kinds of stuff, you know, and I was amazed at how much of an egomaniac I was, or am. I mean, wow, how can this be? And but now that I'm a teacher, I realize that it's, you know, I wasn't alone. You know, we all are, you know, complete egomaniacs, and it's okay. You know, it's what happens to us, and seeing it, you know, it's kind of painful to see it at times. So I sat open to all of this, without working with it, and I look back at these early years of practice. And to realize that a lot of what was happening was acceptance and forgiveness and trust in the midst of all that stuff. And just allowing myself to be who I was, allowing all the stuff to arise, and have the acceptance of myself as that, the forgiveness of myself for being, you know, not a saint, for being someone who's, you know, egotistical, you know, and full of fear and anger towards people, and all the kinds of stuff that I think is just a matter of being human. And those attitudes that arose of acceptance, of forgiveness, of trust, I think those attitudes are very closely connected to compassion. They're maybe not the same thing, but they're, you know, they're siblings. And one of the things that I started to notice at that time, or become sensitive to, was expressions of compassion around me. I started seeing compassion everywhere. And it wasn't like even I was so conscious of it being compassion. But like in my early years as a Buddhist practitioner, very early on, I got this photograph of a statue of Kannon, a Japanese statue of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. And it was the first kind of Buddhist image that I had kind of posted somewhere. And it was of compassion. And I don't know, you know, it wasn't something that I thought out or figured out or logicked out that this is what I should do. Somehow that's what came my way, and I put it up because there was some, perhaps you'd say, unconscious attraction to compassion and the image of compassion. I would find compassion in things that I realized later weren't compassionate, or how to say it. There was this beautiful statue they have; they still have it at the San Francisco Zen Center on Page Street. Some of you might have seen it. It's at the top of the steps when you come up from the meditation hall. And it's a statue of this, it's about six foot tall. It's a flame kind of coming up, kind of wooden flame, kind of, and it's called fire, or I think it's called nirvana, because nirvana is the extinguishing the flame. But anyway, it's this beautiful flame, wooden carved statue. But no one told me, I was a new student, no one told me what it was. So I saw this beautiful statue of a compassionate person there. And every time I would come out of my meditation and go up the steps, the first thing I'd be confronted with is a statue of compassion. And that's what I saw. It was many years later I told it. It wasn't. And people, you know, and I told my wife, I was telling my wife this earlier today, or yeah, Sunday. And I said there was this person who was, I was living together with at Green Gulch. And was the work leader. And I told my wife that I saw this woman as being somehow, I saw her as being the embodiment of compassion. And not in a naive way, you know, but I saw her as being compassionate when I looked at her, and somehow I saw the way she took care of people. And my wife just looked at me in amazement. Her? So anyway, so I was just, you know, and I think I just saw it in so many different places, I think because that's what I needed. And so I didn't know that I needed it, but somehow the universe of my mind was providing it very nicely. So often, you know, our need for compassion is found, you know, in the environment around us. And it's, you know, if you feel like you need compassion, sometimes just be a little bit sensitive to, maybe you can feel it in the wind as it blows against you. You feel it in the sunlight is compassionate. Or you feel it in, you know, just the fresh air. You see it in the smile of a friend or in a stranger. Sometimes it can be very easy, very simple. The compassionate of the universe. So as I kept practicing, then I became more accepting of my own suffering and my own so-called shortcomings. And as I became more accepting and more open to allow myself to see who I was and allow myself to see myself and my shortcomings and my suffering and my pain, the magical thing that happens then is that we tend then to become more accepting and more open to experience the suffering and the shortcomings of others without getting critical or upset or pull away from it or reject it. And so then I started feeling more, becoming more sensitive to the suffering around me, to people around me, much more than I had before. And it's as if, you know, as we sit or as we practice, the mind becomes more settled, or the heart becomes more settled and open. And there's space then to receive suffering, a space to be open to it. When we live in a reactive mind, the mind of all our reactive thoughts, it's too crowded in there for anything to happen, for any openness. But if we can allow the mind to be a little bit still, a little bit quiet, then there's lots of space actually, there's an infinite amount of space to receive, be present for infinite amount of suffering, if that's what comes your way. It said in Buddhism that the proximate cause for compassion is suffering. That, you know, how do I make more compassion in my life? You know, it's by being around suffering. And it isn't like you have to go out and find suffering. It's happening. You know, it's happening. It's happening. And just be open to it. Be sensitive to it. Be willing to be sensitive to it. You know, be present for a little bit rather than turning on the television or the radio or, you know, taking some alcohol or drugs or distracting ourselves. So the gate, you can say the gate to compassion is mindfulness. And that mindfulness is that gate which opens to a connection with the world as it is. And when it's suffering, we connect to that. It's to connect us to what is happening right now. And so when we're lost in our busyness, our ambition, our pride, our fear, there's often very little chance then for compassion to arise because we're not connected. If we're lost in those kinds of sentiments and ideas or in our fantasies about the past or the future, we don't really connect to anything. And compassion only arises out of connection. Love only arises out of connection. You have to be connected to something. And connection, I venture to say, only happens when you're in the present moment. You can't get compassionate in the abstract. Or you can't have love in the abstract. There has to be some connection. It can be connected to a memory even. That's still, but it has to be connected in the present moment for it to happen. So the development of, so the beginning, I think the first step to developing compassion is developing capacity to empathize. And empathy is just simply feeling the suffering of others, or feeling our own suffering, sharing it in a sense. And that's what I think I was doing in my early years of practice, was with the trust, the acceptance, and the forgiveness, I was learning, and the openness, the willing to be present, I was learning to be empathize. With myself and with others, to feel empathy. So after a few years of this, I was living at the monastery, Buddhist monastery, down in Tassajara. And monastic life, you know, is just talk about, you know, opening your heart. I mean, to promote a lot of people, not all people, but it just opens one's heart, you know, wide open. It's a problem at Tassajara because, in that kind of heart openness space, people fall in love with each other too easily. And there's sometimes a problem in meditation practice where with our boundaries sometimes, because it's, you know, your heart becomes so open through spiritual practice, and if you're not clear about the difference between open-heartedness and I don't know what word, but you know, sexual relationships, you can end up kind of confusing the two, which happens a lot, and in spiritual circles. And maybe it's part of, you know, the exploration and the growing up. Maybe it's okay a little bit, but it can also add more suffering to confuse it. So anyway, Tassajara is this, you know, wonderful place. And so I was, you know, feeling quite open and heartful and tenderized. And I don't know why that was funny. into this space, then it was like 1981 or something, and there was and the Israeli army started bombing Beirut. And this happens all the time in the news, you know. It's, you know, every week, you know, you read something like this. But you know, it was the first time that I think I'd really been completely open for this kind of suffering in the world, kind of out there. And it was just so painful to me to kind of experience what was happening in Beirut and the bombing of the refugee camps there. And I just couldn't believe that it was happening. And it was particularly, you know, not only was I very sensitive to this, but I grew up in Europe. I grew up actually on the Mediterranean for a number of years, right on the coast there. And you know, Beirut is also in the Mediterranean. And I actually visited Beirut when I was 11. And it's like, you know, it's like next door. It's like, it was like a place that I could have lived. You know, it was like, it wasn't like off in the jungles of Vietnam, you know. Growing up, some of you might be too young, but growing up in Los Angeles in the 60s, you know, every day in the second or third page of the newspaper, there'd be all the photographs of all the guys who'd been killed. You know, they had photographs, so-and-so died, and so-and-so died, you know. Day after day, I saw that growing up. Anyway, Beirut was just like, it was like where I lived. It was like my back door. It was like war had come home. It wasn't off in the jungles. It had come to where I was, in a sense. It was my feeling. And it wasn't something distant. And I felt it was very precious for me to experience that. It was very painful. But I didn't want to not experience it. I felt, in a sense, that it was partly who I was. That in many different dimensions, what was happening in Beirut was happening to me, was happening by me. It was part of this event of living, is that kind of suffering and that kind of activity. And I didn't want to turn away from it, even though it was painful. You know, because I wasn't separate from it. To turn away is to make yourself separate from others. And I didn't want that. The separation seemed like going in the wrong direction. I said some years ago that we should read this poem once a year, and it's been a number of years since I've read it. The poem by Thich Nhat Hanh called "Please Call Me by My True Names." Do not say that I'll depart tomorrow, because even today I still arrive. Look deeply. I arrive in every second to be a bud on a spring branch, to be a tiny bird whose wings are still fragile, learning to sing in my new nest, to be a caterpillar in the heart of a flower, to be a jewel hiding itself in a stone. I still arrive in order to laugh and to cry, in order to fear and to hope. The rhythm of my heart is the birth and death of all that are alive. I am the mayfly metamorphizing on the surface of the river, and I am the bird which, when spring comes, arrives in time to eat the mayfly. I am the frog swimming happily in the clear water of a pond, And I am also the grass snake who, approaching in silence, feeds itself on the frog. I am the child in Uganda, all skin and bones. My legs as thin as bamboo sticks, and I am the arms merchant selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee in a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I am the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. I am a member of the Politburo, with plenty of power in my hands, and I am the man who has to pay his debt of blood to my people, dying slowly in a forced labor camp. My joy is like spring, so warm it makes flowers bloom. My pain is like a river of tears, so full it fills up the four oceans. Please call me by my true names, so I can wake up, and so the door of my heart can be left open, the door of compassion. So I learned empathy from our practice by paying attention, by just paying attention. That's all it takes, is paying attention. And paying attention is one side of our practice. And the other side, I believe, is the response. So there's attention and response are the two sides. And empathy arises out of attention. It's just simply sharing and feeling in suffering. Compassion, then, is the response. Out of empathy, then, comes the response. How do we respond to the suffering that we feel? Our own suffering within us, the suffering in the world around us. We have to feel it fully. It's the first requirement. And there's no way to get around that. And having felt it, then how do we respond? And that's, you know, the difficult question. But then, one of the reasons I left the monastery was because I wanted to, for me, the monastery had been a place just to develop the openness. And I felt very strongly drawn then to go back into our society and to respond then to suffering. And it became kind of the organizing principle or the motivating force of my life was the response to suffering in the world. And that's, you know, I spent a lot of time in the monastery. I spent about a year reflecting on the purity, so-called purity, of my intention to respond to suffering, to make that kind of the what I dedicate my life to. And I didn't trust it, that kind of dedication, that kind of interest. And there was, you know, some reason not to distrust it, because, you know, I was an egotistical maniac. So, you know, there was, you know, pride and ambition and ego involved with that also. But that was only actually a small percentage of the motivation, you know. And I could, seeing how what a small percentage the egotistical side of it was, I didn't want to let that get in the way of what was a much more pure expression of just wanting to respond to suffering. And so that became then, since that time, it's been kind of the organizing principle of my life, the underlying, what my life is about, I feel, is responding to suffering through Buddhist practice or through practice. So responding to suffering. And that's all it is. We don't have to even use the word compassion, I suppose. There's the openness, the willingness to feel suffering without defense, without aversion, without fear, without criticism. And then allowing ourselves to respond, allowing the heart to respond naturally from that. And sometimes it's said, you know, the important thing is to have compassion with other people, not have compassion for other people. The difference being with is to share with something. For is to hold yourself removed, to hold yourself separate. So I looked up the word sorry in the dictionary this week. Because compassion is a Latin-derived word. And it's not, you know, we don't speak Latin, we speak Anglo-Saxon, right? Old-fashioned English. So sometimes it's nice to go find, what's the English word? Did the English even have a word for compassion before they met the French? but anyway, the word sorry, I think, is that word. And we say, you know, I'm sorry all the time. But I was surprised to see that the root of the word sorry means pain. And it's connected to the word sore. So when you say, I feel sorry for you, or I feel sorry with you, you're saying, I feel pain with you. But we don't say that very often because it feels a little bit derogatory, I think. Kind of condescending to say, I feel sorry for you. It's kind of like you're separate then. But I think the original meaning of the word is, I just simply feel the pain. That's all it is. And to say that to someone, I feel your pain, is sometimes one of the most helpful things you can do. Just be willing to experience it. Be willing to be there for it. I've told this story before. My sister's been very sick for 20 years, on and off. And when she first became sick, there was a time we thought she was dying. She was in the hospital. And everybody went into the hospital room and said, oh, you'll be fine. No problem. You'll be fine. And, you know, out in the hallway, we said, Jesus, you know, what's going to be happening to her? And we opened the door. It's going to be fine. So I came to visit her, and I wasn't going to play that game. So I went to see her, and I said, I think I said something simple like, it's really rough, isn't it? And just to kind of acknowledge the difficulty of the situation. And she started crying. And she was so grateful because someone had really seen, you know, what was going on for her, rather than kind of denying, you know, what was happening. So that was kind of easy, you know, in that sense. And the last month in August, she was very sick again. And it seemed like a kind of another one of her crises, and she was in the hospital again. And this time, it was more difficult for me because the first time I didn't feel any anguish, but this time I felt much more anguish around it. It wasn't just pure compassion, pure feeling the suffering, but actually I felt fear, and I felt guilt, and I felt many worry and many different things that are very complicated for me, the feelings and emotions this time around. And so it was hard. It was much harder to have kind of just be present for her. And I feel it reverberating in our relationship a little bit because I feel, you know, my feeling, well, you know, I feel her suffering and I want to be helpful. I want to be present for her and as best I can. And so I call her regularly and check in with her. But I sense there's a little feeling, you know, in when I call her that I'm calling her because she's suffering, you know, to be of help. And it feels a little bit off to me. Rather than just calling her because, you know, I don't know, just calling her and saying, how are you? There's this feeling I'm doing it because she's kind of having this hard time. And I don't know how to get myself out of it. Because I feel like I can't not call her. Because I have to call her. I mean, she needs to check in. But there's this tinge to the, you know, that I feel. So there's a little tinge in our relationship that I'm not really happy with. So that's what for me to explore and talk to her about. It's not easy to know how to respond. It's not easy to be open to suffering, but the willingness to be open to it, I think, is the real key. And so I'm willing to be in the midst of it. So sometimes people ask me, "What does it mean to be a Buddhist priest?" And you hear many answers. It means you do rituals and you do this and that. But I think what it should mean is, for me, in the essence, is someone who's a Buddhist priest or Buddhist monk or nun, or who's taken some kind of maybe vows. It's someone who, at least in their practice, maybe they can't do it completely, but their dedication is to be unwilling to turn away from suffering. And that's what a priest is. Unwilling to turn away from suffering. No matter how difficult or painful it gets. So compassion, the definition in Buddhism of compassion, it's the quivering, is the word, a quivering of the heart in response to suffering in the world and the desire that arises to alleviate that suffering. So compassion is actually active. It's the desire, the wish to alleviate suffering, to do something about the suffering. But how to respond is a very complicated issue. And it depends a lot on our understanding of what's actually happening in the situation. And that's why it's very important to peer up compassion with wisdom. If we don't have some modicum of wisdom in what's going on, our compassion will often get us into big trouble, and sometimes other people into trouble. There's a story that I've read about some woman who came to another woman who was a Buddhist practitioner who had taken vows of compassion, be bodhisattva, and had asked, what does it mean to be a bodhisattva? And it means, you're here to help all beings. And he said, could you help me? Can you please, I need someone to take care of my child and I need $20. Well, okay. So she took the $20 and had a babysitter and she went to the bar and got drunk. And that's not considered to be wise compassion. That's considered to be kind of stupid compassion, perhaps. Just to allow someone to kind of respond to the request without any kind of wisdom about what's behind there, what's going on. The Buddhist, someone weeks ago complained, or I don't know if complained, but made the observation that Buddhism was hedonistic. And I kind of nodded, sure. But in the sense that Buddhism, likes to focus on happiness, and part of Buddhism is to become a happy person. But happiness is not the pursuit of pleasure. And that's a very important distinction. So in that sense, it's not hedonistic. Usually hedonism is pursuit of pleasure, I think. Happiness, so it's not the pursuit of pleasure. So simply if the suffering of someone is because they're not attaining the right level of pleasure that they're hoping to get, I mean, you can feel their pain, but the pain of not getting what you want and the pain of wanting are two different things. And with wisdom and understanding, what a practitioner will do, I think, is not so much focus on the pain of not getting what you want, if what you want is, I'm sorry for the always the same example. I'm kind of not so smart, but I was thinking the Lexus. And I apologize to the Lexus owners of the world. I have friends who have Lexus. But anyway, so someone feels really, really, it's suffering not to have, be able to have your Lexus or to have, certain, But what we focus on in Buddhism is not so much the frustration from not getting what you want, but we're more often interested in understanding the suffering of the wanting itself. And so the wisdom is you look at the suffering of the wanting itself. What is that wanting about? So the woman who wanted the $20 to get drunk. So what is her really suffering? To really understand what is the core of her suffering actually takes a lot of wisdom and a lot of sensitivity. And if you can meet, perhaps if you can meet that person where the person is really suffering, if you can really see it, maybe the person is just deeply lonely and is trying to drown their loneliness in alcohol. To see that loneliness and to respond to the loneliness might be what the person really wants, not the $20. And so can you see that? So then you respond very differently depending on what you see in the situation is where you see the core of the suffering. And understanding the nature of suffering. It's so important to understand suffering, to give ourselves a chance to really be present for it, to understand it, so we can recognize it elsewhere. But to recognize our own suffering helps us to recognize it in other people. It also, recognizing in ourselves, puts us on an equal footing with other people who suffer. And it's very important, I think, to be on an equal footing and not to be kind of looking down at them. But to start understanding suffering, we can understand sometimes that when someone's angry, for example, if they're angry with you or furious, if you understand the suffering that's behind that anger, it can radically transform your relationship with that person. I've been in both situations where I didn't understand, and I got angry back. But in situations, for example, there was this person on Highway 9, isn't that what it's called, going down to Boulder Creek? Mm-hmm. And I was driving down, and there was a car behind me, driving behind me, and suddenly behind that car came this car. There was lights flashing and horn blowing and kind of riding the person's tail behind me. So the person behind me kind of pulled over, and then it was my turn. And the person was riding my tail in my car, and just kind of honking and flashing the lights, and it felt so angry. And so as soon as I had a chance, I kind of pulled over so the person could pass. You know, well, the person's probably happy that I let them go by. Well, you know what I got? I got the finger. You know, how could you be in my way? You know, how could you have done this to me? Got in my way and not gotten in my way more quickly, and the person was furious. Now, one response for me is to get angry back. But I could feel that to be in a body that has that kind of reaction to other people, to be in that kind of hurry and that kind of reaction to someone who pulls over and to flip them off, there's that body, that mind, that heart, I think, is suffering dramatically. And what I felt then was the suffering of that person, not that person's anger. So I had a very different relationship to that person. And so as a person that stopped, I think I would have related to them very differently, because I recognized the suffering there, than if I had just not seen it there and just gotten angry myself and kind of got into a finger dueling contest. which probably would have escalated. So being sensitive to suffering and the compassion that arises is very, very powerful. And it can transform resentment into forgiveness, hatred into friendliness, and anger into kindness. And I think it just comes, you know, just as it kind of snuck up on me in the early years of my practice, it can just come as you become more sensitive, more willing to be present. As we make contact with the present moment, that's all you're asked to do. Make contact with the present, what's actually happening now. And compassion will come by itself in good time. Well, if you may, I'll read two short quotes. George Washington Carver, who seems to have been an amazing person, very wise man, many said, "How far you go in life depends on your being tender with the young, compassionate with the aged, sympathetic with the striving, and tolerant of the weak and the strong. Because someday in life you will have been all of these." A rabbi told his students that here in this school they would lay the teachings on their hearts. One child raised her hand and asked, "But Rabbi, why don't you put the teachings in our hearts?" "Oh no," the rabbi answered. "Only God can do that. Here we put the teachings on our hearts so that when they break, the teachings fall in." So don't be afraid to suffer.